This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Massive funk, punk, hip hop, soul. It's something that has a driving beat and makes you dance. It's not something where you just sit there and bob your head. A lot of times people think of hip hop as like sitting there and be like, oh, those are interesting lyrics, let me bob my head. No, it's something where people dance and get sweaty.
I seen you dancing. Can we say Boots dances now?
I mean, I've been dancing.
Don't assume that you dance, but the last few shows.
I haven't been to a show.
I haven't been to a show in a while.
Since maybe the early 90s.
No, man, I've been to a few shows, but okay. you was cutting up the rug, so to speak. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what we do is we try to embody the music.
Right.
And, you know, make a visual representation of how we feel that the music feels. And so that's basically what goes on with that. We got a new album out called Sorry to Bother You, which is, it's basically what we do just on a more extreme level. You know, every album that we do kind of takes on its own personality. And
With the show this week, will you have special guests since you're in town? Will there be
probably not?
No, okay.
Who's on stage with us is Silky is part of the crew. She's like a young Tina Turner. If you haven't seen her, I'm sure a lot of people already know her for her own thing. We got just raw musicians. We got Hassan Hurd on the drums. We usually have Benai Rebel Front on guitar, but for this
we go live to Bill McKibben live at the Clark College, and stay tuned.
And you You are tuned to KBOO Community Radio. You are listening to a special live broadcast of Bill McKibben's lecture at Clark College in Vancouver, Washington, here on KBOO Portland 90.7 or online KBOO.fm. We'll be here until 9 o'clock tonight as Bill McKibben takes the stage to lecture from 7:30 to 9. I'm Ani, and I'm here along with my co-host.
I'm Josie Lichten. Tonight's special program runs from 7:30 to 9 p.m. If you tuned in to hear Drinking from Puddles, this program has graciously ceded its time to make room for the special live broadcast. We'll be going back to the KBOO studio at 9 p.m. for Drinking with Puddles. They have a special guest tonight, and that will be hosted by Brandon at 9 p.m. again.
So Bill McKibben is a well-known environmentalist. I'm the founder of 350.org. It's an international climate change campaign. His 1989 book called The End of Nature was one of the first books to expose the issue of climate change to the general public. Bill's most recent book, Earth, isn't so positive. It makes the claim that we have destroyed the climate to such a large degree that the planet we live on is no longer the same planet it was 60 years ago. Earth goes on to urge global economies and governments to buckle down for the worst, saying that there's little hope of avoiding major climate crisis and disaster at this point.
Though Bill has called himself a professional bummer-outer, not all of his work is about apocalyptic climate change. Bill's also written on a variety of topics, including a critique of modern newscasting, a warning on the dangers of genetic engineering, and a commentary on a solo hiking trip. Bill contributes to several magazines, and he has won the Lannan Prize for Nonfiction Writing, in addition to the Guggenheim and the Lyndhurst Fellowships. He's a scholar in residence at Middlebury College in Vermont, and he was called the planet's best journalist by Time Magazine. Bill was also one of the founders of 350.org, an online platform that has been one of the most influential in organizing the public around climate change issues for the past several years.
350.org is, in fact, one of the most outspoken critics of the Keystone XL pipeline, an oil pipeline that would travel between Canada and the United States. If the Keystone XL is fully developed, the resulting oil production would bolster the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere by 12 to 17%. 350.org has also carried out extensive protests and petitions against the use of fossil fuels. And, you know, this Friday, KBOO has a very special day of fundraising planned. And we are looking at issues of climate change throughout that day, along with many other issues. This Friday, KBOO is trying to raise $12,000 in a single day of fundraising. And what we're doing is going from 8 in the morning till 10 at night, taking a break from all regular programming and taking you on a tour of the Southern Hemisphere. It's the middle of winter there right now, but things are heating up as the impacts of climate change hit the Southern Hemisphere first. Today, Friday, we'll be taking you through the South Pacific, New Zealand, Antarctica, Sub-Saharan Africa, South America, exploring a lot of different current issues, culture, music, and of course, climate change in each region.
And from 8 to 10 p.m. on Friday, we'll round off the day with 2 hours of Brazilian and African music, so that should be fun. Again, this is a one-day flash drive fundraiser, and we're trying to raise $12,000 by the end of the night at 10 p.m., so call your membership.
In on Friday.
At 877-500-KBOO and pick up an audio flash drive with all of Friday's programs and much, much more.
That's right. We have...
So we're going to come to you now with a quick news story. Recent analysis comparing stock market portfolios with fossil fuel investments versus those without show that fossil fuel-free portfolios outperform those with investments in energy companies.
One study performed by Impacts Asset Management demonstrated the difference after tracking equity markets for the past 7 years.
These results calculated portfolios without fossil fuels companies would have made 2.3% per year compared to 1.8% for those portfolios including fossil fuel companies. For more, we go to Raquel Bennett speaking with Daniel Kelsler, Communications Director for 350.org.
Can you tell me what was analyzed in the report entitled Beyond Fossil Fuels, the Investment Case for Fossil Fuel Divestment?
Sure. A stock trading company called Impact Asset Management did a study where they tracked the stock market's performance over the last 7 years in the international equity markets. And they showed that if you have a portfolio that doesn't have fossil fuel companies like Shell or ConocoPhillips or ExxonMobil, that you would actually outperform those portfolios that do have interest in fossil fuel companies. So one of the arguments against...
Later this week. This summer, 350.org has partnered with Portland Rising Tide to bring you Summer Heat Northwest, the Columbia River Climate Action. 350.org, formed in 2007 by Bill McKibben and a few university friends to build a global climate movement. They organize using online campaigns, grassroots organizing, and mass public actions. Rising Tide is an all-volunteer international network of climate activists confronting the root causes of climate change and working for climate justice. Climate justice is the theory that those least responsible for climate change are the most impacted, and that real solutions to the climate crisis must take social inequalities into account. All across North America, Rising Tide is organizing to confront fossil fuels. From fracking in the Northeast to mountaintop removal in Appalachia and the tar sands blockade, we work hard to stop fossil fuels. There are a lot of amazing groups working to confront climate change and stop these projects through the regulatory process. But a key thing that Rising Tide does is continue doing that work when those efforts fail. Tonight, each of you has a postcard in your program pledging to engage in civil disobedience if the Vancouver oil terminal is permitted. I'd like to encourage you all to take that pledge tonight and either leave it on your seat or give it to someone in Rising Tide on your way out. This summer, 350.org is taking the national climate movement to the next level by confronting the fossil fuel industry in the last 2 weeks of July, the hottest weeks of the year. With 11 regional actions planned, Summer Heat is taking our climate movement to the next level. Here in the Northwest, we're gathering on July 27th at the Vancouver Landing to protest the proposed coal, oil, and gas terminals in our region. With a flotilla that spans across the Columbia and a march across the I-5 bridge. The day kicks off at 10 a.m. with workshops and a rally, and then continues with an action at 1:30. At this point, we are not asking folks to engage in mass arrest. Our fight is not there yet. But if these projects are permitted, we will need to engage in mass civil disobedience, and that's why it's so important that you all take that pledge here tonight. This Summer Heat action is creating an image of how our communities will respond if these projects are permitted. Our communities and our climate cannot allow these projects to move forward. And this action is a demonstration of how we can stop these if they are permitted. We're having these events here because Vancouver is becoming the epicenter of the fossil fuel fight. With proposals to increase coal trains to nearly 40 each day, and 4 oil trains supplying a mega oil terminal at the Port of Vancouver, Vancouver is slated to lose a lot. We're all slated to lose a lot. Increasing the number of coal trains passing through Vancouver each day is inconvenient and unhealthy. With longer delays from trains and toxic coal dust blowing in the atmosphere, these trains will not go unnoticed. And the proposed Vancouver oil terminal would facilitate the burning of 380,000 barrels of oil each day. Our communities and our climate cannot handle these impacts. We have to stop this terminal. There are over 14 other export proposals planned for this region. And if you'd like to learn more, there's an export forum next Tuesday, and there's more information about that in your program. Vancouver is emerging in the national spotlight, and decisions made here will influence how the nation moves forward with fossil fuels. With irreversible climate change just around the corner, We cannot afford to burn these fossil fuels. And that's why we're asking you to join the fight in stopping the Pacific Northwest from becoming a fossil fuel corridor. If they can't ship it, they can't burn it, and it stays in the ground. And that's how we stop climate change. Thank you all for coming, and now we have a song by two cool activists, and it's a sing-along, and I hope you all enjoy.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Lee, and this is my friend Megan. We're Portland natives, and we decided to write a cool, just rewriting a cool song, rewriting the words to "Home on the Range." We will have the lyrics up here, I think, and we'll have the lyrics up here, I think, and we'd love for you to sing along. One of the main reasons why I wrote this song is because I'm amazed at how many people still don't know about coal, and I especially want to get youth involved in this process. So if you have any kids who are interested in helping out with coal, have them talk to me or volunteer with your local group. They have great ideas and should be a part of this too. So without further ado, we will begin very soon. just spreading the word, I think, is really important. I also made 80 of these t-shirts last year. They're really simple, and kids have really good art projects and way to spread the news. I'm stalling here, but I would love to also... yeah.
All right.
Should we just sing it anyways? All right.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Megan and Lee for that song. It was awesome. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our featured speaker. Bill McKibben is the author of over a dozen books about the environment, including The End of Nature, which is regarded as the first book on climate change for a general audience. And on a personal note, I have read numerous of Bill's work in college courses, and I'm so honored to be introducing such an inspiring author and activist here today, Bill McKibben.
Thank you all. Can you hear me talking through this? Is this good? Well, look, what a pleasure for me to get to be in Vancouver, Washington, where I've actually never been before. I've heard about it, of course. I knew about Fort Vancouver and all of that. But every time I've come to this part of the world, they've just kept me over in Portland. And I guess they keep everyone over there, because otherwise everyone would come over here if they knew about it. It's a beautiful place. I got to get up this morning and go down the river in a boat with the Columbia Riverkeeper, and it couldn't have been nicer out on the water. And then this afternoon, my wife and I got to walk the downtown and do a little shopping and a little eating. And this is a good place. And I guess what I want to talk about tonight, I think most want to address my remarks to people from here in Vancouver who may, in a certain sense, be wondering why it is that what would normally be a kind of local decision about what to do with this oil port is turning into big national and maybe international to-do. And to explain that, I need to tell you a little bit about where we stand with climate change. I know most of you know about global warming and understand the basic function of what's going on, but it pays to be a little bit, to just sort of go through the details one more time just to make sure we're on the same page, because understanding the scale and the pace of the trouble that we face is pretty instrumental to understanding what we can and can't morally or logically do going forward. Now, as Maya said, I wrote the first book about climate change 25 years ago now, a book called The End of Nature. At the time, global warming was still a fairly abstract proposition. We knew in theory that as we burned more coal and gas and oil and put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that's the inevitable byproduct of fossil fuel combustion, we knew that the molecular structure of that CO2 traps heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. What we didn't know 25 years ago was how quickly and how hard this would pinch. And the story of the last 25 years, sadly, is that it's pinching harder and faster than we suspected that it would. So far, human beings have raised the temperature of the Earth about 1 degree Celsius or 1.8 degrees or so Fahrenheit, okay? Which doesn't sound like an enormous amount. I mean, if it's, was 70 degrees when we walked in here today and it's 69 when we walk out, none of us will be able to tell the difference, okay? But it turns out that the planet can tell the difference even with that relatively modest increase in heat. Our planet is a big place, and so that represents actually a massive amount of heat in the system. The equivalent of extra heat being trapped by that CO2 of exploding about 400,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs every day. Okay, that's how much extra heat. And you can sense what that heat does when you start looking at the effects. So for instance, if you look up at the Arctic, 80% of the sea ice that was there 40 years ago is gone now. There's only about 20% in the summer of the ice left that, say, Neil Armstrong saw when he looked down from the moon. Think of the amount of heat that it would take to melt that many feet thick of sea ice in a very cold ocean, and you begin to get some sense of how much we've added to the atmosphere. And of course, once you start with these changes, they begin to feed on themselves. The Arctic is a good example. Where we've melted all that ice, we've replaced a nice white mirror that reflected much of the incoming sun back out to space and replaced it with blue water, which soaks up that incoming solar radiation and amps up the whole process. If you think about it, we've taken one of the five or six biggest physical features on Earth and we've broken it, okay? And that's a very sobering thing. It's also very sobering to look out at the world's oceans and realize that if you put a pH strip in, it comes out a different color than it would have 40 years ago. The chemistry of seawater changes as it absorbs carbon from the atmosphere, and so the oceans are about 30% more acidic. If you ask the oyster growers and things along this coast, they will tell you that that's already made life difficult for them. And you can be sure that it's also therefore made life very hard for all the creatures at the bottom of the marine food chain, you know. On land, the thing that we've noticed, I think, most profoundly around the world is changes in hydrology, in the way that water moves around the planet. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold. That's just basic physics. And because we've raised the temperature about a degree Celsius, the atmosphere on average is about 5% wetter than it was 40 years ago. That is a very large change in a basic physical parameter of the Earth. It's really the best sign that we've left behind what scientists call the Holocene, this 10,000-year period of benign climatic stability that underwrote the rise of human civilization. And we've entered into something else, and that something else is unsettling. When we look around the world, we see drought on a new scale because that heat is evaporating a lot of water. But once that water's up in the atmosphere, it comes down, and so we see big increases in flood, in downpour, in the kind of storms that do farmers no good, but that produce huge headaches for everybody else. Someplace around the world now, this is happening almost every day. 2 years ago in Pakistan, the Indus River it flooded to the extent, they had the greatest rains they'd ever measured, and the river flooded to the extent that it covered about a quarter of the country and forced 20 million people out of their homes. A month ago in India, they had the worst monsoon tragedy they've ever had. The monsoon rains came weeks early and in unprecedented volume, and 5,000 religious pilgrims were killed, washed away, drowned. A few weeks ago, it was Calgary in Alberta that had the greatest rainstorms they'd ever seen. It filled the hockey arena to the 10th row of seats with water, you know. Something like this happening now every day. At the same time, we see unprecedented drought. Last year was the warmest year in American history, and by a full degree. And it got too hot across the Midwest to grow food. I mean, this is the richest farmland on Earth, but if the temperature is above 95 degrees or so for the crucial stretch of days, corn can't fertilize. It did not fertilize last year, and so we had major crop failures. And around the world, people paid the price with big increases in the price of food. All of this is what happens when you increase the temperature 1 degree. But the same scientists who told us that that would happen are robust in their conclusion that we will raise the temperature 4 or 5 degrees in this century unless we get off coal and gas and oil very, very quickly indeed. If we keep pouring carbon into the atmosphere, 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, 8 or 9 degrees Fahrenheit, it's very hard to have a civilization on that kind of scale. A team at the University of Washington 3 years ago, a team of agronomists published an important paper showing that from this point on, each degree increase in global average temperature can be expected to cut grain yields about 10%. You all know something about grain here. A great deal of it comes down the Columbia, you know. Try to imagine a world 2 or 3 or 4 degrees warmer with 20 or 30 or 40% fewer calories on it. Then try to imagine how you make that world work. What kind of war and peace, what kind of development, what kind of hunger. We can't let any of this happen. And so we have to figure out how to staunch that flow of carbon into the atmosphere quickly. Now, you would think that knowing all this, and scientists have been patiently explaining this for a quarter century now to our leaders, that we would have taken some action. But we have not taken action. Washington has seen a basically quarter century bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing. And it's been entirely successful. And the reason is really clear to anybody who thinks about it for a minute. The richest industry in the history of the planet, by far, is the fossil fuel industry. Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. Okay, and you know enough about our political system to know that money carries a lot of influence. The influence that it's carried so far is a kind of protection for that industry. It's kept it from having... Well, it's the only industry in the world that gets to pour out its waste for free. Nobody else. I mean, we had dinner in a nice restaurant in Vancouver. I have no doubt that the owner of the restaurant would like the right to, at the end of the day, just take his garbage out and dump it in the middle of the street and walk away. It would be cheaper than paying someone to cart it away. But if you did that, pretty soon Vancouver would be overrun by rats. So civilization doesn't makes us clean up after ourselves unless we're the fossil fuel industry, in which case we get to dump
the most dangerous stuff in the world now, carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere absolutely for free. And that's why it is so difficult for renewable energy and things to compete. We know that it's not technology that's the limiting factor, because we can look at a few places around the world that have actually tried this and see the changes that they've wrought. For instance, there's one big country in the world that's really made an all-out effort. It's Germany. It's ironic, in a sense, that the country that caused more than its share of the 20th century's problems is providing an awful lot of the 21st century's solutions. Germans, there were days this summer when Germany produced more than half the power it used from solar panels within its borders. Okay? And this is Germany. I mean, Munich is north of Montreal. Think what a country could do that had, Arizona, New Mexico, California, Nevada, Florida, Texas, the Oregon Desert, to work with. There are more solar panels in Bavaria than there are in the United States. Okay? It's not technology, it's political will to do anything about this that gets in the way. So, what I want to talk about tonight is the kind of movement that's begun to build around the world to try and do something about this. 4, 5, 6 years ago, a bunch of us from many different directions, groups like Rising Tide, many others, began to figure out that the fossil fuel industry had all the money, and that's why they were winning, so we would need to deploy, we'd need to kind of work in other currencies. We're never going to match them in greenbacks. We'd have to find the kind of currencies of movement, passion and spirit and creativity. And yes, as Maya said, sometimes we need to spend our bodies, and go to jail. And so we began organizing. Now, at 350.org, we started in 2008, and it was myself and 7 undergraduates at college in Vermont, where I live. And we had no idea at all what we were doing. There were 7 undergraduates, and there are 7 continents, so each one took one, and we set to work. Okay. And our work was to kind of spread this message about climate. We took our name, 350, from what the scientists were saying was the most carbon we could safely have in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million, a number we're already past. Earlier this year, some of you may have seen the stories about how, in fact, the world hit 400 parts per million CO2 for the first time in about 5 million years, so the first time since really the start of primate evolution, So we're already too high, and in a way, it's a kind of depressing name if you think about it, but it's also a kind of call to everyone to action. It's the equivalent of when you go to the doctor and the doctor says, your cholesterol's too high now. It's above the limit. You're in the zone where people have heart attacks. That's generally the point where people actually start to, what pill do I take, how do I change my diet? What am I going to do? And that's the effect we hoped would happen around the world. The reason we really chose the name, that we took this sort of odd scientific data point, was because we wanted to work all over the world, and so we needed a number, something Arabic numerals translate every place. And when we began, we asked people to take a day, one day in the fall of 2009, to kind of rally in their place and make this point. And we had no idea if it would work. We got the first sense that it would work a couple of days early. It was supposed to happen on Saturday, but we were all sitting around our office on Thursday doing last-minute chores, and the satellite phone rang, and it was our organizer in Ethiopia. Like many, almost all our organizers, like me, a volunteer. And in fact, like many of our organizers, this one was 17 years old, and she and her sister, 16 years old, in charge of Ethiopia. And she was in tears on the phone, and she said, the government just took away our permit for Saturday's demonstration. So we're going to go ahead today and do it before they can stop us. That was brave, but that wasn't why she was crying. She just kept saying, we so wanted to do this at the same time as everybody else. We so wanted to be in the same, do it with everybody. We don't want to spoil it for people. We're so sorry that we're doing it in advance, and we have 15,000 young people right now out in the street in Addis Ababa chanting 350. So I was like, you know, Leah, it's okay about the date. Don't worry. And after that, for the next 48 hours, the pictures just rolled. The next one actually came from U.S. troops in Afghanistan. They'd made a 350 with sandbags. They sent a note saying, we're parking our Humvee for the weekend and walking, you know? And then the pictures just roll, and I'll just show you very few. They just came from everywhere. The thing that interested me most, in a way, was seeing, I had always heard that environmentalism was something that rich white people did who had taken care of their other problems, you know, and it was really interesting to see that most of the people we were working with around the world were poor and black and brown and Asian and young, because that's what most of the world is made up of, okay? And some of them really, I mean, this is, you know, someplace in the Congo River above Kinshasa, those are dugout canoes. They didn't even have a digital camera. They tried to develop it in someone's home darkroom. It didn't come out so well, so they just wrote in what their banner had said. But there they were, you know, in the place that Joseph Conrad had called the heart of darkness on our planet, and they were fully enmeshed. And the same kind of creativity happening all over the place, you know. For me, because I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, it was fun to see the involvement of religious communities for the first time in a big way. That's in South Africa. That's the head of Muslim South Africa, the head of indigenous traditions in South Africa. Behind them, the Anglican Archbishop, Desmond Tutu's successor, at the head of a big multi-faith march. There's our biggest evangelical college. I'd been to Bethlehem and the Holy Land to do some organizing. Not an easy place even to get to, really, so much tension around. But the Dead Sea has shrunk dramatically as temperatures rise, so people wanted to do something. Too many military checkpoints in the way, so the Jordanians said, we'll make the big three on our beach. The Palestinians said, we'll do the five in Palestine. The Israelis said, we'll take care of the zero. It was beautiful to see, you know. 300 demonstrations across China. It's not easy to do this kind of thing in China. One of them got broken up by the police, but the other 299 went off, and it's important. The Chinese are doing things wrong, but they're also doing things right now. They're the biggest users of renewable energy on Earth. These are our friends. Just to give you some idea, these are our friends in the Maldive Islands in the Indian Ocean. This is a country, an archipelago of islands in the Indian Ocean that has a continuous culture stretching back 5,000 years. But it's pretty unlikely it's going to reach 5,100 because the highest point in the archipelago is about 1.5 meters above sea level. Okay, so these guys are probably out of luck, but they're trying as hard as they can. This was the biggest story on Google News for about 36 hours. More newspapers and things linking to it than anything else. And I think one reason is that the people didn't look like what editors think environmentalists were supposed to look like. That's Yemen. That's the toughest place on the planet in certain ways. And that zero is all women in full black burqa, you know. To us, they do not look like members of the Sierra Club or something. But their hearts are in just the same place. They're not thinking about themselves. They're thinking about the future. They're thinking about the larger fabric of creation. They're, you know, that's who they are. That's Abu Dhabi. Those are, it's an oil-rich sheikdom, and you can see some oil-rich sheikhs down front there in their distashes. But these guys are smarter than your average oil guys, because behind them is the largest solar array on planet Earth, the edge of it. These guys, I think, are determined to remain rich no matter what, you know? And more power to them. There were also 400 or 500 pictures that ended up in a file just labeled 350 adorable, you know? And they really were adorable. And they really were sad, too. Those girls probably going to be refugees in the course of their lives, and not from anything they did, you know, just because the water's rising on their island home, you know. So that's when we think about decisions about things like coal or oil ports here in Vancouver. Part of the things we think about correctly have to do with safety. Do we want a repeat of what happened in Quebec 2 weeks ago with the massive explosion of the oil train, you know? And part of the thing we think about are environmental local hazards. Do you want to take the beautiful river and the coastline of Oregon and Washington? And do you want to run the risks that go with shipping ever more barges and tankers full of oil up and down? Okay, those are legitimate and important questions to ask. Do you want to take cities and towns and turn them into basically train terminals with endless long waits at grade crossings? Do you think that's a smart economic development strategy? On and on and on. And you guys will know how to weigh some of those risks against whatever benefits you perceive. But you also need, I'm afraid, at this point in history, with the Arctic melted and the ocean acidifying, you also need to weigh the risks to people like those. Okay? Because this area has emerged as this great choke point, a place where either you'll open the floodgates to coal and oil and natural gas streaming out of the interior of North America, the tar sands from the Powder River Basin, this sort of thing, or you'll say, no, actually, that's not going to happen here. And if it doesn't happen here and a few other places along the coast, it really can't happen anywhere. Geography is destiny in a way, and there's just no way to affordably get that stuff out unless they can do it through your backyards. And if they can't, then they won't be drilling and mining and digging it up, at least in the same quantities. So you play a really important role. I could show you these kind of pictures all day because we've organized about 20,000 rallies in every country on earth except North Korea. And they're beautiful to look at. I like looking at them and seeing the kind of work that people have done all over the world to kind of try and come together and do something. We've done huge art projects, so big you had to view them from outer space with a satellite. So that's in Santa Fe in a dried out riverbed, and a couple of thousand people, when the satellite went over, held up these blue blankets and sheets to bring the river back to life for a second. It was very beautiful to watch. I could show you those pictures all day because that educational component was really important. But I want to, just in the few minutes I have left, just talk about the ways that that this fight is escalating and what to expect and think about going forward. It's getting very serious. 2 years ago, we took on the first of these big infrastructure projects with our friends all around the country, this so-called Keystone Pipeline. And the reason we took it on was that our greatest climate scientist, Jim Hansen at NASA, had published a paper saying there's a lot of carbon up in those tar sands in Canada. In fact, he's calculated, if you burned all the economically recoverable oil in Alberta overnight, which happily you probably can't do, but if you could do it in one night, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 would rise from its present 400 parts per million to 540 parts per million, just from Alberta. And we'd have no chance of doing anything at all about climate, he said. Go like that and it's game over for the climate. So we took on that pipeline, which was, people thought was a done deal, signed, sealed, delivered, gonna be built. And instead, 1,253 people came to Washington and got arrested in very, very, very civil disobedience, you know. It was the largest civil disobedience action about anything in 30 years in this country. And it kind of presaged what is starting to happen now all over the country and all over the world. A few weeks later in Canada, the same kind of action up on Parliament Hill, and then Our friends are all around the world at 350 outside American and Canadian consulates and embassies. And then we followed Barack Obama all around the country, and we wrapped the White House in people, shoulder to shoulder, five deep. And at a certain point, the president said, okay, we're going to take a year and we're going to study this more closely. And some people thought it was a kind of cynical move just to push it past the election. And maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but we've kept up the pressure. We don't know how this fight's going to come out, but 2 weeks ago, the president gave a speech in which he said for the first time, he talked about this pipeline explicitly, and he said, we're going to make the decision based on whether it adds more carbon to the atmosphere or not, which is the right basis on which to make that decision. And we're feeling more hopeful. At any rate, for 2 years, the pipeline company was so sure that it was going to be built that they mowed the strip they were going to put it on, and they have pipe positioned all across the middle of the country in lots and fields everywhere. And it's been sitting there rusting for 2 years, okay, which is good. Now, the reason that we do this as hard as we can is because of those effects that are happening. We asked last spring, a year ago now, if people around the world would rally in places that had already felt the sting of climate change. And we, even though we're used to doing these big days of action, we were astounded. There were thousands of demonstrations from people saying, look what we're suffering now. The day starts in the far Pacific, so the first demonstration was underwater in the Marshall Islands and on the coral reef, because coral reefs are just disappearing in that hotter, more acidic ocean, you know. You'd think in Afghanistan they had other things to worry about, you know, but the fact that the Kabul River is drying up is pretty high on the list, and on and on and on, you know. Sea level rise in New Zealand. Some places the worries are a little less, you know, completely, but for those of us who like to ski, the fact that winter is disappearing is no small thing. And of course, some of it was along this part of the world. Bellingham's one of the places where they planned these big coal ports, and people are up in arms. You may remember in this, some of you in this hall, when they had the scoping hearings the state held, and this hall and the overflow hall were overflowing with people there saying, no, we're not going to do this up here. It's the effects of wildfire, the effects of sea level rise, the effects of evaporation. That top red balloon, that's where the level of the Dead Sea used to be, okay, 40 years ago. That picture, just one of hundreds from India, just some small village someplace in India. But the reason it stuck in my mind is it just came with a note that all the note said was, there is no water behind our dam anymore. You know, the same kind of thing. These are people in that district in Pakistan that I told you about where 20 million people were forced from their homes, you know, by flooding. All over the place, including the snowpack of the Pacific. That's my home state of Vermont, where Hurricane Irene did almost unbelievable damage 2 years ago. But the same thing in every corner of the world, you know, place after place after place. And those are some of our friends stopping the coal train in British Columbia, stopping it for the day. And I think there'll be more of that. But the picture that stuck most in my mind was this one from Haiti. It was probably the smallest demonstration of the day. And just some muddy river, you know, muddy street turned into a river by flooding. It's the sign that people, kids were holding. The guy just said, your actions affect me, okay? Which is true. I mean, more people died in Haiti from Hurricane Sandy than died in New York, all right? There's still a cholera outbreak going on in its wake there, you know? Your actions affect me, but not the other way around. There's nothing anybody in Haiti can do to really alter the outcome of this story. They don't burn much fossil fuel, so they can't cut back. They don't have big companies that do this kind of thing. All they can do is appeal to us. Your actions affect me. And the truth is, that, you know, Vancouver and the rest of the Pacific Northwest will take action one way or another that will have deeply outsized effect on these people. That's, in certain ways, a burden that you have to weigh that in your mind, that you're not able to just do, you know, without thinking about it, what might come naturally or obviously in the past. It is kind of a burden, but it's also kind of a privilege to get to be able to do something that will help people around the world in a huge and significant way. You can do some of those things by changing your light bulbs at home or changing the car that you drive or whatever, and those are important gestures, and I bet that many people in this room have made them. But do not fool yourself into thinking that by measures like that we really dramatically affect the outcome of this story. This problem is structural. It is systemic. It has to do with the price of carbon, and it has to do with the power of the fossil fuel industry to block any attempt to take it seriously. That's why we take them on. Let me just end. I was talking to a bunch of religious leaders in Portland, in Oregon, earlier today. And I was sort of thinking of stories from when we did that civil disobedience, those arrests. And I know that there are people thinking that they might have to do it here. So I just want to kind of tell people a little bit about what it was like, so that you're not alarmed at the prospect so much. And if you live here, you're not too freaked out by the possibility that people might come and engage in what is, after all, a long American tradition. When we did that work in Washington, I wrote the letter asking people to come and get arrested, which is not an easy kind of letter to write. And we said two things in it. One of the things we said was, I don't think that college students should have to be the sort of cannon fodder here, okay? Because, you know, they've done most of the leadership. You've seen many, many pictures of young people up there. But if you're 22 in our economy, maybe an arrest record is not actually the very best thing for your resume, you know? By contrast, one of the few unmixed blessings to growing older is, past a certain point, what the hell are they going to do to you, you know? And so it was fun. It was fun to watch people coming to Washington with sort of hairlines like mine, you know? We did not ask people as they were getting arrested, how old are you, because that would be rude. But we did cleverly say, who was president when you were born? And the two biggest cohorts that got arrested came from the FDR and the Truman administrations. Okay? On the last day, there was a guy arrested, 93 years old, with a sign around his neck that said, World War II vet, handle with care. He was so old, he'd been born in the Harding administration, which was long enough. I was an American history major. I'd forgotten there was a Harding administration. Okay, so this was a long time ago. The point was, it was really good to see elders acting like elders, taking some responsibility for how they were leaving things, okay? And that's why I have no doubt that if it comes to doing that here, that's many of you will be in that position and in the lead there. The other thing we said to people was, if you want to come get arrested, okay, would you please put on a necktie or wear a dress when you come? Not because, I mean, look, this is how I normally dress. I mean, I live in Vermont, which I think makes, you know, Washington look formal, you know, in its approach to haberdashery. But we wanted to make a visual point, and it's the same point I've been making all night long, which is there's absolutely nothing radical about what I'm talking about. All we're asking for is a planet that works a little bit like the one that we grew up on, the one that we were born onto, indeed, the one that every human being that we have any history of for the last 10,000 years, that they were born onto. That's all we want, is a planet that works a little like that. That's not a radical demand. If you think about it, that's a very conservative request. Radicals work at oil companies. If you're willing to get up and make more money than anybody's ever made before by altering the chemical composition of the atmosphere, by taking the one atmosphere we have on the one planet that we have and changing its chemical composition in ways that scientists have told you will be ruinous, and that you can now see by watching places like the Arctic is indeed being ruinous. If you're willing to do that, then you're engaged in a more radical act than any human being that's come before you. And our job is to figure out how to check that radicalism as best we can. And one of the places we can check it is right here in the Northwest. It's a key part of this fight. Let me just end by saying, because you've seen all these pictures, that you know it's not the only part of this fight, and that there are people all over the world that are engaged in this, and all over the country. If I seem a little tired, it's because I'm the kind of moving part in this summer heat event. I was in Michigan the day before yesterday, where they're working to block pipelines down from the tar sands. By tomorrow, I'll be in Moab, Utah, where the first big American tar sands mine is slated to be built. On to Maine the day after that, so on and so forth. This is a really interesting movement. It does not have leaders, really. There's no Martin Luther King of the climate change movement. What it does have is local people all over the world who are concerned about local problems and local effects of climate change, but all of fossil fuel development, but also now understand in increasingly aware ways the global implications of what they're doing. Climate change is the first global problem that we've ever faced. It therefore demands the first kind of movement like this. And happily, we have some of the tools like the internet that make it possible to go global in that way. In fact, the movement looks more and more the way we want the energy system to work. Not a few centralized coal-fired power plants, but millions of solar panels on millions of rooftops all linked together. And the movement needs to look the same way. Not a few, leaders or big organizations or something, but millions of people, all kind of interconnected, but working in their own place and doing what needs doing. It's a very beautiful thing to see, and I'm so grateful to those of you who are part of it, and I hope all of you will be. I can't promise you that we're going to win. I can promise you, I think, that we're going to win on many of these fights along the Pacific Northwest. I think we're going to stop an awful lot. We've already stopped 3 of the 6 proposed coal ports and others to fall soon, But I can't promise you we're going to win the overall fight. We've waited a long time to get started on climate change, and the science is pretty dire. It's not a good sign when the Arctic melts. It's a pretty potent reminder of the sort of vulnerability of our technological civilization to the change we've already made when you watch the Atlantic Ocean fill the New York City subway system, okay? These are bad signs. But I can promise you that there's going to be a fight here and everywhere else. A peaceful fight, but a determined fight. And that's, for the moment, got to be enough. We don't know how it's going to come out, but we do know that it's going to be a fight. And for me, it's just a great privilege to get to fight shoulder to shoulder with you all and to say thank you for the work and the leadership that y'all are showing. Thank you all very much.
That has been Bill McKibben for this evening's lecture. We will be having some audience participation, some questions and answers here over the next several minutes, probably going right up until about 9 o'clock tonight. So you have been listening to this special broadcast live on KBOO Portland, our community radio station. And there is going to be a little break before the questions and answers. But just to let you know, you have been listening to Bill McKibben. He's the organizer with 350.org and one of the leading journalists on climate change in the world today. McKibben is speaking tonight at Geyser Hall at Clark College. I'm Ani,
And I am Josie Lichten. Thank you for joining us. And in just a moment, we have audience members approaching the stage now for questions.
First of all, Bill, I just want to thank you so much for the work that you do. I just think it's super, extremely important. And you know, I've read a lot of what you've written, and it's always made very much sense to me. And I've listened to you talk, and it just makes a lot of sense to me. It just, you know, it's science-based, and I believe in science, and you know, but what I want to ask you is, I guess, how to talk to people about this, because to a lot of people, I think it doesn't make sense, and it's like you say, a global problem. It's very big, and I think people tend to view it in terms of their own life, which isn't very big. So, so there's a big disconnect, you know. Big problems, and maybe you have a suggestion or two.
So one of the things is that it's getting much easier, not because of things we're doing, although that helps a little bit, but because of things that are happening around us. The polling data shows that far, far more Americans are concerned about global warming now than even a few years ago. I mean, like a spike of 30% or something in the polling data. And the reason's pretty clear. 85% of American counties have had a federally declared weather disaster in the last 2 years. Mother Nature is providing a kind of endless series of teachable moments, you know. And there are people for whom this just won't get through. If you've, you know, sort of spent your time for the last 20 years kind of marinating in Rush Limbaugh, you know, it's the odds of you getting, you know, being willing to deal with the science are small because you've heard a sort of steady parade of attack on science and on reality. But most people are there. The issue more for me is not trying to convert the last 25% of people to reality on this. It's taking the 75% who know what's going on and making them active, getting them engaged, doing what needs doing. And I think that's mostly where the numbers come in. Thank you. Thanks.
So I'd also like to thank you, Bill, for all you've done in the climate movement. You are the Martin Luther King equivalent for the climate movement.
I don't want to disagree with you, but I do want to say very clearly, I think it's really important to understand that we're in a different age with different kinds of movements now, and it's really important that they not operate off leaders. I mean, my only use in a setting like this is to just give people an excuse to come together and talk, okay? Mm-hmm. But that's the, you know, the work, the real work that will happen here tonight has nothing to do with me. It has to do with the work that you guys will do with each other. But go on.
So I'm going to be a college student at Oregon State University next year, and I'd really like to be involved with the efforts to stop fossil fuels and basically mitigate climate change. My parents don't want me to really get involved with being arrested and stuff like that. But
speaking as a parent with a college student, I understand their concern.
But I just want to know, like, what kind of stuff can I do? Like, how can I convert non-believers?
I can answer this question. It's as if it was the perfect setup. We launched a big campaign last year to get colleges, universities, and others to divest their holdings from fossil fuel companies. Okay? It's been going extraordinarily well. There are now fights active underway on 380 college campuses. Six of them have already divested, but not OSU, so you can, you know, do the work there. A lot of...
Our divestment group is here today.
Oh, excellent. That's good. So the other thing, though, is that it started to spread beyond colleges. So 15, 16 big cities have now divested. The first was Seattle. Mayor McGinn led the fight. And I had a meeting yesterday with the mayor of Portland, Mayor Hales, and he's on board too, and in Oregon's gonna try and get the state, which has the big pension funds and things, to divest, which will be good. It's now spread to around the world and to religious institutions, which I think is really important.
The Uniting Church in Australia, the big Protestant denomination, divested a couple of weeks ago, which was amazing because Australia is coal country in a big way, you know. Last week, the United Church of Christ in this country voted to divest its holdings in fossil fuel. That's a big deal. They're the kind of they're the sort of descendants of the pilgrims, you know, the kind of original church in this country. So the message in both practical and moral ways is spreading and quickly. And one of the things that people are realizing is that it's probably a good financial idea anyway to get out of this industry, because if we ever took climate change seriously, these companies wouldn't be able to keep burning coal and gas and oil at the rates that their business plans call for. They'd have to leave many of their reserves underground. HSBC and Citibank published a report last month saying that if we took the world's very modest temperature targets seriously, if we did what we'd said we were doing as a planet, you'd have to cut the valuations of all the fossil fuel companies in half. Okay? So go to work on divestment. The movement has spread enough that it was quite interesting. In his climate change speech a few weeks ago, President Obama said at the end of his speech, he said, "I want you all to invest and divest." Okay, so there's your marching orders from D.C.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Hi, I know there's a lot of people behind me. I have a lot on my mind, and you can just choose to answer whatever you want. I don't want to stir up trouble, but I love that you're focusing so much on the solutions rather than the problems. But I think that there is wisdom and truly seeing accurately and completely what the problems are. And I'd like to know a little more about, you've talked a lot about the Arctic. I'd like to know a little bit more about what's going on in Antarctica. And I'd also like to know your thoughts on geoengineering and chemtrails. I'd like to know what you think about Agenda 21 as well. So if you can just kind of share with me some of your thoughts on those, I'd appreciate that.
Sure. We think that in the Antarctic, we know that the mass of ice in the Antarctic is decreasing as well.
Really?
We think it's accelerating. What seems to be happening is, and the Antarctic is not as well studied as it should be, but what seems to be happening is, as water temperature is warm, it's undercutting the glaciers at the sort of snout of the glaciers that hang over the ocean. And as those begin to crumble, the speed with which the glaciers behind them can slide into the ocean is increasing. So the sort of best indicator, the one we know most about, is the Pine Island Glacier. It's the most studied, and it seems to be moving with increasing rapidity. So not good news for the most part.
Okay.
As for geoengineering, there are people who say, let's keep burning fossil fuel and we'll figure out some way to counteract its effects by putting something else into the air. Okay, so the most prominent example of what people talk about is we'll fill the air with a lot of sulfur, and that will counteract it'll cut enough of the incoming sunlight, okay, that we won't warm up as much. And if you think about it, we actually have no idea whether it will really work. The computer modeling seems to indicate that if it does work, it will also move the monsoons off the Asian subcontinent, which is kind of a big deal to the couple of billion people who depend on them for water. It would also turn the sky a kind of milky white, which would be sort of sad in its own way. And it would do nothing at all to slow the acidification of the oceans, which, even if that was the only result of the carbon we were pouring into the atmosphere, it would be more than enough reason to get off fossil fuel immediately. This planet's three-quarters ocean, you know. It is not wise to monkey around with the chemistry of seawater. So I think the real answer is, I used to run a homeless shelter, so I knew a lot of junkies, and I liked them, But they had a kind of logic of their own, you know, that really involved never having to deal with the consequences of their actions. Something was always going to be there to kind of, you know, they're going to win the lottery or something, you know. Deciding that having filled the atmosphere with one chemical and it caused bad problems, we now might want to fill it with another chemical. That strikes me as pretty close to sort of the logic of junkies. And it would be a lot smarter for us to stop pouring carbon into the atmosphere, especially since we now know what we need to do. You know, we now know that the sun and the wind and things are useful sources of energy and benign ones. So that's where I'd head. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bill, I certainly appreciate the worldwide focus you've taken on this. Let me ask one of those worldwide kinds of questions. To your understanding, what proportion of the world's gasoline is still leaded gasoline?
I don't know. I think most of the world is now off leaded gasoline. You know, the last place I remember encountering it in really large quantities was Bangkok. I mean, you could feel yourself losing brain cells as you sat in traffic. And Thailand is now on unleaded gasoline. The Chinese are on unleaded gasoline. For the most part, I think India is too, although I'm not as sure about that. But, you know, lead in gasoline is a really interesting story. The same guy, check this out, his name was Thomas Midgley, who put lead in gasoline and ended up, you know, just to keep it from knocking, ended up, you know, poisoning, shortening the lives of zillions of people in the process. The very same guy was the guy who invented the compound, the family of chemicals, chlorofluorocarbons, that took out the ozone layer. Okay, so. A lot of things seem like a good idea at the time, you know, I think is the underlying message here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi there, Bill. I started, I guess, a little bit slow in my mental processes when you began, and I could have sworn you said something like there's a 1.5 increase in temperature over so many years, and that's the equivalent to 400,000 Hiroshimas a day. Did you say something like
yes.
that? Could you elaborate?
Sure. So the planet's a big place, right? So on the one hand, the increase in heat is small. So so far we've increased solar. Put enough CO2 in the atmosphere to increase solar radiation by about 0.75 watts per square meter of the Earth's surface. So, you know, roughly square meter of the Earth's surface, less than one of those small white Christmas tree lights per square meter. On the other hand, there are a lot of square meters on the surface of the Earth, okay? So if you add them all up, that's the heat content of what we're pouring out there. It's not that we're exploding bombs and there's no radiation and it's not, you know, whatever. That's just how much heat that it, and it's just to give you a sense of how hard, you know, just how incredible it is that we've been able to do things like melt the Arctic. I mean, that's a feat of almost, I mean, think of the inertia that exists in ice sitting in cold water, feet of it that have been there for, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, and that we've figured out how to intervene at that scale is just worth bearing in mind. Thanks.
Hi, Bill. I have worked with planetary scientists and atmospheric scientists, particularly out at Mauna Kea in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they would like to see brought up a lot in conversations about the impact of CO2 is the rate of CO2 change, and in comparison to past events on, you know, in Earth's history, where this rate reached the level that it is currently happening at. Do you talk about that? And the second part of the question is, do you ever talk about the impact of CO2 on Venus in comparison to Mercury?
We don't spend a lot of time thinking about the other planets because they have, you know, their they have a whole series of things that govern their climates and atmospheres that aren't applicable. We do talk a lot about the rate of increase in CO2 because you're right, it's the crux of the problem here. This is happening at a speed far more rapid than we've ever seen in the past. And if you think about it, what's going on is we're digging up hundreds of millions of years worth of biology. That's what the Powder River Basin is. It's millions of years worth of dead trees and plankton and whatever else, okay? And we're digging it all up in the space of a couple of decades and tossing it into the atmosphere. And it would be a miracle if it wasn't doing something strange to the Earth. And of course it is.
Bill, I want to put my question into context. About 3 weeks ago, I gave a reflection at my UCC church in White Salmon, Washington, on climate change and coal exports. We live about a mile above the gorge and the river. And last weekend, another reflection was given at my church, talking about the moral hypocrisy of environmentalism. And it has strengthened my resolve in why I'm doing this, and so thank you. But can you lend any further thoughts on what we're up against?
Well, so the question about hypocrisy is an important one, and I imagine what they were saying was, well, you're still driving a car, or you're still, which is true. Look, there's no way to totally avoid using fossil fuel in the current setup that we have. I mean, you'd basically have to imprison yourself in a room someplace and starve to death in order to be entirely free of it, you know. We should all use a lot less, and I trust that people are working in that direction. But that's not an argument for not taking on the fossil fuel industry, because it's the fossil fuel industry that's making sure nothing ever changes, okay? So if you're, say, invested in Chevron, then you were part of making the biggest campaign donation post-Citizens United in history. 2 weeks before the last election, designed to make sure that the House of Representatives stayed in the hands of people who would do nothing about climate change. And it was successful. So we have to deal with this in the systemic and structural way that, I mean, that's what we have time to do. Physics is setting the timetable here. And it's telling us to move quickly, and that means that along with making changes in our lifestyles, it's even more pressing to try and take these things on in systemic ways. Good question.
Thank you.
So the petroleum product thrift store shirt that I just stripped off to expose my Keystone Arrest T-shirt. And I've had to replace the Stetson that was my tie equivalent for my White House arrest because it finally gave out to many years of solar energy. Happened to be at the Stetson thrift or Stetson outlet store in Garland, Texas, so that was an opportunity. But could you please speak to consumerism, materialism, and the ways that the fossil fuels industry exacerbates and encourages those things? It ties, I think, to the question we just had about hypocrisy and to geoengineering as a junky solution. Thank you.
Look, most of my intellectual work, when I ever get to do any intellectual work in recent years, the books I've written and stuff have been about what a post-fossil fuel world looks like and how, as we move off fossil fuel, I think we move inevitably towards a more localized world that probably begins to satisfy its needs and wants more with things like human connection than with endless consumption, okay? Which will be a good thing, because we can't keep consuming at the rates and ways that we are. But I think that the most powerful way to get there, the quickest way to get there, is probably the same as the most quickest way to deal with climate change, to put a serious price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the atmosphere. And that would remind us constantly not to be using so much of it and to be using other things instead. I think that's the wedge that gets us where we need to go. We can't do it because the fossil fuel industry won't let us do it. Okay? It's not because it wouldn't be perfectly popular. All you do is put a tax on gas and heating oil and things, and then take the money you collect and write everybody in the country a check every month for their share. I mean, the theory is, if the sky belongs to anyone, it belongs to us, not Exxon. You know, they're going to use it as storage space. They should pay some rent. You know, and that would be a useful way to do this without bankrupting anyone in the process, sending those signals. So, but we won't get there until we've weakened the political power of the fossil fuel industry. That's why we sit down in front of pipelines, and it's why we divest stock, and it's why we take on, why we play both offense and defense, why we try to stop bad projects and try to weaken this industry, because it's not a normal industry. Its business plan would tank the planet. That's what I get.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank 350 for the good things that they've done. Rising Tide, of course, KBOO, and Earth First, which also gets actually gets stuff done. So I'm going to start out with a comment, and then I have a question. My first comment is, I think people need to understand exactly how racist the environmental, all these environmental travesties are racially motivated. There are people of color from marginalized communities that are being terrorized in their community, being poisoned. They're seeing their family members die. You need to understand that. So not to target anyone, but understanding that privilege that you might have, some of the people in this room, when you're dealing with those communities is important. So making comments like comparing this gentleman to Martin Luther King Jr. is incredibly offensive to some people. So just keep that in mind. That being said, myself and some of my activist friends had a question for you. And that was Houston, Texas, around that area, there's a lot of things going down. I got family out there. And I've had activist friends that have like put in a lot of work, a lot of heart, as well as community members, poor people that did come out to Washington, that did get arrested, and that felt that their voice was going to be heard. And some of those people felt that maybe attention was put, you know, spun onto the organization to get more funds, and they ended up going to jail, already coming from bad situations and not being able to say, hey, this is who I am, and this is the pain and the struggle that I'm going through. So I'm just wondering, in front of all these people here, with Meaty here, if there's something that you can say to these people from these marginalized communities that have felt disempowered and felt that your profits mattered more than their empowerment.
Well, I don't know about profits. I mean, as I said, I'm a volunteer in this work, and always have been. What we've tried to do, and will keep trying to do, that's what the point of this whole summer heat thing is, you know, to go around the country to places where climate justice organizers and people working on these things are bringing these issues to the fore and trying to support and bring spotlight to them where we can. So we'll be in Texas soon and in Richmond, California. That's where it's all going to end in a few weeks. And if there was ever a kind of example of what you're talking about, it strikes me it's probably that Chevron refinery in Richmond. There shouldn't be a refinery in the middle of a community, especially a refinery that tends to blow up like it did last year. And something like 5,000 people ended up getting texted alerts saying, get out of your house, leave. You know, that's what the company, that was their evacuation plan, was to text people saying, go, you know. Either that or don't breathe, you know. And so it's really important to keep highlighting that kind of work. It's also really important to keep highlighting it around the world. One of the things that we just trained 500 young people from 135 countries in Istanbul a couple weeks ago. 10-day training session to get them set to go do this kind of work. And one of the things that's always so apparent when we do this is that climate justice and environmental justice, looked at from a global point of view, starts to look different too, you know? That the poorest people in the world are the ones who are getting hit absolutely the hardest all the time. And when you get, say, when we were starting this divestment campaign, it was Desmond Tutu who really gave the best video, I think, that we got. And he said, if you could, he's an old friend of 350 and a big help, and he said, if you could see what famine and drought look like here in Africa, where we've done nothing to cause the problem, you'd know why we're asking you to take the same tool we used to fight apartheid, divestment from corporate America, and do with it what we can, wield that weapon again. That's where we're headed. That's what we hope to do. But it's always going to be a difficult fight.
I was just wondering what you had to say to those people, though. I appreciate what you're saying, but they kind of wanted a response.
Doing our best to be in solidarity with people all over the country and all over the world, and we'll keep doing it. Thank you.
Do you think that an 11-year-old like me, with a supportive family, could get a local city like Beaverton, Oregon, to join your divestment campaign?
This, you know what? I'm I am flat worn out, and so this is, with apologies to people, I think this is where I'm going to end this, because this is the perfect question I want to end on. Yep, the answer is yep. I told you that some of our best organizers around the country were just a couple of years older than you, around the world, 16, 17-year-olds in places like Addis Ababa. We need people your age leading. You have a kind of credibility in this fight. And here's the reason. I'm going to be dead in 20, 25 years, if I'm what, that's how long I'll last, okay? So I will have lived most of my life in a world where the world mostly worked, okay? But unless we get our act together soon, you're going to spend most of your life, because you've got another 80 years on this planet, you're going to spend most of your life in a world that's not working well, where at a certain point, too much of human resources will just be devoted to a kind of endless emergency response to things, We can't let that happen. And so it's really important that the testimony and the witness, people like you, galvanize everybody else to go to work. And I was talking before about the kind of intergenerational dynamics here, okay? So when you got up and spoke, one of the things you did was speak to the hearts of a lot of people in this room who have children or grandchildren and help them understand why it was so important, that they, maybe sign that card that's on the chair about whether or not they might be willing to resist when the time came or whatever it was. It's harder to turn you down than it is to turn me down, is the way to say it. And so I just really, really, really want to thank you for coming tonight. And if you don't mind, I'd like to shake your hand as we end this evening. So
thank You have been listening to a special live broadcast on KBOO Portland of environmentalist Bill McKibben speaking at Geyser Hall and answering some audience questions at the Clark College campus in Vancouver, Washington. I'm Josephine Lichten.
And I'm Ani. We want to thank you very much for joining us. And we want to thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support, which makes all of this possible. Live broadcasts like this one and so much else that KBOO brings you all day long, every day. Anyone can join KBOO online. You can do it right now. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. I want to let folks know or remind you, we heard this at the very beginning of the talks tonight, there are a couple of days of action coming up. Tuesday, July 23rd, there is a forum on fossil fuel export. That's 6:30 to 8:30 at the Levin Community Center in Portland. That's at 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue. Also, there's the gathering Saturday, July 27th, Columbia River, Vancouver Landing, west of 100 Columbia Street in Vancouver. And there'll be workshops from 10 a.m. till 12:30 p.m., speakers until 1:30, and then an action planned at 1:30. You can find more information about any of these events at portlandrisingtide.org. We now return you to our regularly scheduled program, Drinking from Puddles, with the fabulous musical extravaganza live guest tonight in studio with your host, Brandon.
On Friday, July 19th, from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., tune in for KBOO's one-day flash drive fundraiser, a day filled with news and music from the equator to Antarctica.
Lecture topics will include climate change, gay rights, and an overview of African land grabs. Don't miss out on the chance to explore underrepresented music and news from across the Southern Hemisphere on July 19th from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Hey, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM here in Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis, Albany, Oregon. White Salmon, Washington, Columbia Gorge, hello to you at 91.9 FM and worldwide. Hello, you're listening at www.kboo.fm. And no matter where you are, welcome to a very special edition of Drinking from Puddles, a late start tonight, but extended show, as said just a moment ago, special live in-studio guests are going to be on it as well. Jenny Don't and the Spurs, lots of stuff. It's going to be exciting. 9 to midnight this week. Normally, this program runs 8 to 10 p.m., and then the Life During Wartime Best in Punk Rock program from 10 p.m. to midnight. But instead tonight, this special extended edition of Drinking from Puddles from 9 p.m. to midnight with Jenny Don't and the Spurs, our special live in-studio guest. I am Brandon. Lots of other music, new and old, as well. Let's get things going here with something new from Anna Von